Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, single-payer healthcare in America. Is it worth getting excited about? Many Americans have begun to talk about the potential benefits of replacing the existing health insurance system with something like Medicare for Americans young and old. We'll spend this hour with Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal of Kaiser Health News. She says it will be hard to know how well such an idea could work until politicians start talking much more specifically. But we will talk about the possible features of a government-administered health system, about how other wealthy democracies handle health care, and about what might happen to the health care business if millions of Americans no longer rely on private insurance. Our conversation starts after a short break. This week, my mom had a hip replacement. Thanks to her fancy new titanium implant, she is expecting to be walking easily, pain-free, as soon as she is done with recovery. The technology feels pretty miraculous, but honestly, so does the fact that it was covered by Medicare. She's on a fixed income, like a lot of retired people, and without insurance, that new hip would have cost more than $30,000. It's enough to make you wonder, would we be better off as a society if the people calling for Medicare for All got their way? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The thing is, lots of politicians, mostly Democrats, but a few Republicans, have started talking about Medicare for All or a single-payer health system. And often that rhetoric is greeted enormously enthusiastically by folks of working age who've seen government-run health insurance work well for their parents and grandparents. What we don't hear a lot about is the details. How exactly would such a system work? How would we pay for it? And have we thought carefully enough about what working families would gain and lose compared with the care they receive through private insurers? Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal is editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News, a trained emergency physician and the author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. She recently published a news analysis op-ed in the New York Times called Don't Get Too Excited About Medicare for All. Elizabeth, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So we hear people talking about single-payer health insurance, and we hear people talking about Medicare for All. What is the difference exactly?
Well, they're basically part and parcel of the same idea. One is that a single-payer means basically that the government pays all the bills for health care, and Medicare for All means that we adopt a kind of Medicare-like system that we apply for everyone, where the government pays all the bills, but also the government would then negotiate prices for hospital stays, for medicines, and it would make it arguably much simpler for everyone because, as you said, for your mom, you know, Medicare is generally fairly low stress to use compared to private insurance. So, you know, it would bring costs down. It would simplify the paperwork because you wouldn't have 1,000 negotiations going on between your doctor and your insurer and the hospital and your insurer and in-network, out-of-network. All those things go away.
Some people worry that the buzzword language of either Medicare for All or single payer is not really any different than repeal and replace calls for the Affordable Care Act that don't come with any fully fledged alternative ideas. Is that a fair criticism?
Yes, it's something that I worried about in that news analysis. And it's not that I'm saying we shouldn't be interested or even excited about the idea of single payer or Medicare for All. It's something we should think about and consider as an option, but we really have to know what it means and what kind of trade-offs it entails. And I worry, you know, that it becomes just another buzzword, as I think it is doing in some races, meaning I hate this healthcare system, because who doesn't hate this system? The question is, okay, so what are we going to replace it with? And we need to replace it with something that's real and well thought out and where we've considered our values and our trade-offs. And that takes serious discussion, not just throwing around like, you know, repeal and replace or single-payer Medicare for All. I think we need to know what we mean on either side of the equation. And it was clear that with the Republicans, when they kept saying repeal and replace, they didn't have a specific plan in mind. And you know, that contributed to the fact that they failed in the end.
So, of course, we already have Medicare, and it's, you know, got a long track record. Would creating a plan that was concrete to extend the reach of Medicare to everyone be as complex to put together as something like the Affordable Care Act?
Yes and no. I mean, you could say tomorrow we're just going to expand it to all ages. But of course, you know, we many hospitals and physicians and the healthcare industry, you know, the insurers have different ideas about that. And partly because if you expand it to Medicare for all tomorrow, the hospitals and the doctors will get lower reimbursement and overall because they don't have the private payers who pay far more than Medicare generally. And the insurers, what are they supposed to do? You know, what's their role in a single payer system? Generally, it's very tangential. So we in this country have to deal with a kind of bifurcated problem. What's best for our health care? And what do we as patients want, which I think should be paramount. But we also have this huge business of health care in this country, and that employs a lot of people. It some would say is in line with American values. We believe in the market and free enterprise. So, you know, there's a lot at stake here and a lot on the table.
Is there any way to know what would happen to all those jobs? I mean, there are probably millions of families that rely in some way on income from the private health insurance system these days.
Well, yes, that's true. You know, the problem is often they rely on the inefficiency of the private healthcare system for making money. You know, the coders, the billers, the people who you speak to on the patient helplines, the every hospital, every doctor's office has people, you know, in hospitals' cases, hundreds of people doing billing, arguing billing, talking to patients. In doctor's offices, maybe it's only two or three getting pre-approvals. Well, a lot of that goes away. Now, you could argue in a more rational, streamlined system, those people aren't doing truly useful things in terms of healthcare, but those are real jobs. And, you know, that's a real tough one. On the other hand, I would say, you know, there are so many parts of our healthcare system that we don't staff because there's not a business model for them. You know, people could be doing a lot more in the way of home care, in the way of feeding patients who are discharged from the hospital, elderly patients who may not have a way to get food at home. I mean, there are a lot of things we don't do because we don't have a business model. So you could see that, you know, if you're an optimist, you could say, wow, we could take all those jobs that don't have a purpose in a more streamlined system and repurpose them to meet our national needs if we had a national payer who could think about those needs. Or you could say, if you know, like anything, if it's done poorly, you have a lot of unemployment and no benefit. So I think all of these moves take a lot of forethought. And, you know, we like to think of everything else out there in the world as, you know, a single payer system or a socialized medicine or government run. In fact, a lot of countries do something that's neither our, you know, all-in market-based system nor a single-payer private, single-payer government-run system. But they all have better ways than we do to control pricing. So, for example, Germany, Switzerland, they still have insurers, but they have price schedules limiting what physicians and hospitals can charge for a procedure. So, you know, that's another, and they limit the price of prescription drugs. So you could go that route, too. So I'm not saying, I'm not endorsing one route or another, but I am saying almost everyone hates their health care right now. It's way too expensive. We're bankrupting families. We're making companies not able to afford to hire new people because of health care costs. So that in itself creates a huge drain on our economy. So we need to fix this. And it's a political decision how we fix it, whether we go to a more market-based or a more single-payer kind of system. But not understanding the trade-offs and what those systems mean means we're going to be stuck where we are, which is everyone says, wow, you know, drug companies are getting away with murder and prices are too high and nothing changes.
Since we're back to politics, maybe you can help me understand something that has honestly perplexed me for a while now. I mean, regardless of what people thought privately, for years it was just politically impossible to say out loud that you wanted a Medicare for all system or a single payer system in the United States if you were running for elected office. It didn't matter if you were a Democrat or a Republican. Why have these ideas gained so much traction in public discourse in the past couple of years?
Well, I think one thing is that kind of Bernie Sanders opened the door for a dialogue during the 2016 presidential, the Democratic primaries. So I think there was that. But I think even more important, the reason more people were willing to walk through it is because over time, you know, 20 years ago, you had employer-provided health insurance. You didn't pay very much in the way of your premium. Your employer covered that. You didn't have copays. You didn't have deductibles. Those have crept into Medicare in a bigger way, too. And now we have everyone has these big out-of-pocket expenses for health care. They're paying more of their premiums. And the system has become bizarrely complex with in-network, out-of-network, surprise billing. So I think people are just fed up with a system that doesn't work very well for anyone anymore, including physicians, many physicians who say, enough, I'm tired of being on the phone negotiating pre-approvals. I'm tired of not knowing what I'm going to get paid. I'm not in a position to spend half of my life bargaining. So we're seeing among physicians, too, who, you know, for whom Medicare for All would have been anathema 30 years ago, a majority of physicians, when in many polls, say, okay, fine. So I think that's why we're seeing more of it, that people are so frustrated with this system that they're willing to, you know, say, okay, let's try something completely different. And the narrative, you know, when I started covering healthcare, it was about, you know, well, in Canada, they wait a long time and, you know, and we have the best medical system in the world. I think that's flipped now where more and more, when I talk to people, they're like, wow, I have a brother in Canada and he got this cancer treatment for free. Hmm. And I think we have to understand, you know, there are trade-offs. Yes, you may wait more in a Medicare for All or a more socialized system. But, you know, we have people waiting in this country because they don't have good insurance or they can't get pre-approval for a procedure. So, I mean, there's no perfect system. Every healthcare system has kind of warts and all. Costs are going up in every country because technology is more, there's more medical technology, it's better. But, you know, we're still paying twice as much about as any other developed country. So that tells you we're doing something very, very wrong.
Twice as much for equivalent procedures, care, that sort of thing.
Well, actually, for worse results, that's the irony. And I think that's what's pulled many people around, too, is we pay twice as much. And when you look at, but when you look at health outcomes, we rank pretty close to last among the developed countries. So it is true that if you have an unusual kind of cancer that takes a very new drug, you may be able to get it first in the U.S. You may be able to, not necessarily, before you would get it in a more government, a system with more government intervention that would first have to decide if that drug had merit and whether they were willing to pay for it. And before they had to negotiate with the drug company to get a price that they felt was reasonable. So you might be able, in theory, to get it first in the U.S., but whether you would be able to pay for it or your insurer would be able to pay for it, maybe not. And there are a whole bunch of drugs, and I think this is really important for Americans to understand, that we get after everyone else in the world, particularly the generics, the biosimilar drugs. that, you know, there is biosimilar, there has been biosimilar, essentially generic insulin on the market in Europe for a few years now, not in the U.S. We just heard today that the FDA had approved a biosimilar, again, a generic of a drug called Humira, which you see advertised on TV all the time, that treats a lot of autoimmune diseases like arthritis and intestinal diseases. Now, that's approved by the FDA, but it won't go on the market in the U.S. for another 3 to 4 years because in this country, there are patent issues, there are lawsuits. So, you know, I have to jump in here
and take a break. Hang on. My guest is Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal. We are talking to her about her recent New York Times op-ed, "Don't Get Too Excited About Medicare for All." Back in 2 minutes. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, who is by training and experience an emergency room physician. She is editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News and author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. She had an article recently, an op-ed in the New York Times called Don't Get Too Excited About Medicare for All. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 800-933-5372. So, Elizabeth, a few minutes ago, you were talking about the fact that we might get some early experimental drugs in the United States earlier than people in the rest of the developed world, but we don't necessarily have the advantage when it comes to affordable options, generics and things that are that exist in the world but cost less than the brand name sold by U.S. pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah, it's very specific, comparing drug to drug. We do get generics for cheaper drugs very quickly, and that has brought down the price even more. You see a lot of these $5 prescriptions at Target, and that's a great thing. But the really expensive drugs, where the manufacturers fight against generics being able to come to market, in the U.S., they're very successful in those fights, in those court fights, and in Europe, they're by and large not. So the very expensive drugs tend to have generics or biosimilars first in Europe, and that takes a lot longer to get here.
I want to talk a little bit about how we pay for a system like this. These days, Americans who have private health insurance, many people buy their insurance through their employers. Maybe their employer kicks in part of the premium as a benefit of employment. Is there any way to estimate how our payments under a Medicare for All system direct to the government might compare with the money that is pulled out of our paychecks to pay for health insurance if that's available to us at work?
Well, that's a really hard comparison to make at the moment. And you know, a lot of the state bills have fallen on just this issue that, oh my gosh, we'd have to raise taxes by 12% now, or something like that. Now, your assumption is that we will keep paying the kinds of prices we pay now, which certainly under a Medicare for All system, what happens is the government has massive bargaining power and uses that to get lower prices for hospital stays, for drugs, for devices, for everything. So what I can give you is a comparison. Say in Germany, which has a very good medical system, they expect everyone to contribute 8% of their income if they're working to as a contribution towards their health care insurance, which you know, that covers everything, soup to nuts, pretty much, including dental care. The employer kicks in another 8%. So for people who are working, it's about 15-16%. If you're not working, you pay your portion and the government pays the other portion. And if you're really poor, the government pays everything. So, you know, I think there are certainly ways to adapt it. What I always tell people when they say, oh, you know, that would be crazy taxes. And again, I'm not saying we should move to a single payer system, but I tell people, add up how much you pay in premiums, how much you pay in out-of-pocket expenses, deductibles, co-pays, add that all up. And I think for a lot of Americans now, that's more than 20% of your income. So, you know, maybe a tax rise wouldn't be the worst thing on earth. So I think we have to make sure we're comparing, you know, apples to apples rather than apples to oranges.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now first to Stanford in Plano. Hi, Stanford.
Hi. I love our country, don't get me wrong, but I don't see that the federal government coordinates practices or policies or agencies very well. I mean, look at what they've done to the VA and look what they've done with the American Indian Bureau. They just don't seem to be able to work on this and keep things running smoothly. I just hate for them to get into our healthcare system and muddy the waters there as well. And I had a friend that had a skiing accident in Canada, blew out a knee. And when she went to the hospital, they said, but you're over 55, so we're not going to fix this. We'll give you a cane. She was like, what? So she got a med flight back to Dallas, and Southwest Medical School fixed her leg. So I just think we've got to be so careful about suggesting the federal government take care of us. I think we need to take care of ourselves, don't you?
Thank you so much for your call, Stanford. What do you think about that, Elizabeth?
Well, I think, you know, there's a valid point there. There probably are more issues in Canada about, you know, should we do this knee replacement? Is this a knee that we should fix? As opposed to in the U.S., where I think we go in and we fix too many things that would probably heal on their own. You know, there's a lot of financial incentive to get a knee replacement, to have knee surgery, when maybe time and some physical therapy would be the right answer. Now, in terms of having the government be involved, you know, yes, there's certainly a lot of dysfunction in government agencies, but overall, I can tell you, you know, when I hear from a lot of readers across the country, and people generally like Medicare. It's popular. I hear a lot of people in their late 50s and early 60s talking about, I can't wait to get to the promised land of Medicare. So, and I hear from a lot of people who in the U.S. can't get their knees fixed, who are barely walking. You know, I had a taxi driver on one of my trips in the Midwest, and, you know, he was limping along, and he said, I can't get this taken care of because I can't afford my, you know, I have a high deductible plan, and I can't afford that $7,000. So I'm just living with it. So, you know, there are certainly, you can pick certain cases on either side of the argument. But I will say that Medicare is pretty popular. So, you know, maybe the answer, and some people have suggested this, is not Medicare for all, but allowing people to buy into Medicare as an option if they want that. That's a pretty interesting idea, too. So if you look at the health plans on offer in your region or in by your company, and you say, I don't like any of these, really. They don't match up to what Medicare might offer me. You can do that. So that's another kind of strategy.
We hear fairly often about somebody being busted for, you know, alleged fraud against Medicare providers. Is government-funded care any more or less susceptible to fraudulent claims than private health insurance is?
Well, private health insurance is probably a little better and a little better funded at ferreting out fraud and abuse. They have more incentive to, in the sense of they have shareholders they have to answer to. It takes away from their bottom line. But I think part of the problem is there's this huge gray area in medicine that's somewhere between fraud and, you know, well, you know, we're just kind of embellishing how we're billing. And that happens in the private market. It happens in Medicare. Very hard to ferret out and track because, hey, I don't know if I'm reading that paperwork. You know, what happened in the operating room? Did you really need a second surgeon there who billed $50,000? Who knows? So this is a big challenge on both sides of the on both ends of the what kind of system do we want spectrum. There's certainly a lot of fraud. There's certainly some fraud. There's certainly a whole lot of abuse, things like upcoding, where you have we've all seen this, you know. You saw a doctor for 3 minutes and suddenly you see it's been billed as a complex visit. or your kid gets some stitches in the ER, and you know it was kind of a little, maybe a half-inch cut, and it was billed as 2 inches. You know, it's just kind of embellishment, which gets you a lot more money, which hospital-based physicians are often encouraged to do, frankly, because it's good for the bottom line, but it's terrible for medicine, it's terrible for our health spending, and it's what's leading us to this place where we're spending 19% of our GDP on healthcare, which is means we're not spending that on schools, on transportation, on, you know, flood relief, all these other things that we really need to pay attention to.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Next, we'll speak with Kirk in Dallas. Hi, Kirk.
Hi, great show again.
Thanks.
And bravo, Dr. Rosenthal. You're hitting all of the notes that resonate with me. I'm going to make this as short as I can. I've been involved in, you know, for a number of years, I was in the business of healthcare. It was in prevention. It was in nutrition. And I learned a lot. One of the things that I came away with, I assert that we don't have so much a healthcare system in the United States as we do an illness and suffering for-profit system, and you've been very, very beautifully illustrating those facts. And the lady who called last before me illustrates even more that what we have, in my humble opinion, in this country is capitalism as religion. And in America, not everything under the sun works as a purely for-profit mega industry, and that's medicine and healthcare. We see that with what you just described, 19-20% of the gross domestic product being shoved right through a small hole to pay all for all of these huge hospital complexes and for all of the huge profits that these industries are making. So I just wanted to put my two cents in.
Thanks for calling. Do you want to respond to that, Elizabeth?
No, I think, you know, I do think that, you know, when you look at our hospitals, when you look at our, particularly our hospitals, you look at the marble lobbies and the grand pianos and their expansion and their building, and you just, you know, someone like me, I look at that and I think, wow, that could be much better spent on actual health care. I, you know, and by way of comparison, when you look at the famous hospitals in Europe, like the Curie Institute in France, you know, they're not fancy, but they deliver absolutely fabulous health care. And I think we all, as Americans, as consumers, have to focus on what health care should be, which is not a hospitality industry. That doesn't mean you should suffer. It doesn't mean we have to go back to the days of, like, disgusting Jell-O and frozen peas in hospitals. But it does mean we should focus on the things that matter for health. And, you know, we are not doing that because everything needs a business model. Everything needs a payment structure in this country right now. I mean, we're talking to one person here who, for colon cancer, had a colon surgery, was wearing a bag for a while, and got better. They wanted to reconnect the colon. And, you know, the insurer said, oh, no, that's a new procedure. That's a different thing. That's elective. You know, that's crazy, right? And in a different kind of system, we wouldn't even be hearing that. But in our system, where every item is billed, every procedure is billed, every test is a new negotiation with your insurer and the hospital and the lab, we end up with a lot of crazy outcomes.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It's interesting to think about the effect that competition has on the quality of health care we receive, because as you're talking about, you know, when hospitals are competing for patients, especially patients who have a choice and are not in an emergency situation, maybe it is nice to have rooms that are particularly elegant or lobbies that look great or a fancy menu. But even in a system of something like Medicare for All or a single payer system, you're still competing for individual patients, right? So in terms of care, doctors would still be motivated to provide the best possible care, or else patients can choose another doctor who will be reimbursed by a single payer.
Right. And we do find in other countries, there are certainly competition among hospitals for patients based on reputation, sometimes based on some element of price. When people are paying out of pocket, they want to know they're getting good value for their care. In some systems, they'll say, okay, fine, you want a private room with a nice view? You can pay a supplement for that, but that's not normal in our system. That's not where we want our healthcare dollars to go. So, a more regulated or price-regulated kind of system or a single-payer system doesn't mean an end to competition. And, you know, the ironic thing for me about competition in healthcare is we think of that as being good because competition in every other sector, the players are trying to offer you quality, but it also lowers price. You know, since there are all these different widescreen TVs I can buy, I get a better price. What happens in healthcare is exactly the opposite. No one competes on price. So if you have five hospitals in a city, and maybe it's Dallas, maybe it's San Francisco, and they're all charging a lot, it's the actual opposite because insurers pay based on usual and customary. So if everyone's paying a lot, that becomes the norm, and that's what we all pay. So in healthcare, we find the exact opposite of what competition should do, according to economic theory. It keeps if there are five hospitals all charging a lot, it keeps the price high the same way as having a monopoly would keep the price high. So, you know, I'm fine with market-based systems. I'm okay with profit, but this is not a market-based system that works. And the profits, I would say, as we see from, all of the companies involved in healthcare are just astronomical as people are suffering. And that's not okay with me.
Let's assume for the sake of argument that Americans decided that this was something we wanted. What would the transition look like?
You mean to a single-payer
Medicare? Yeah, from the kind of patchwork system we have today.
Well, I mean, you know, that's the big challenge for people who believe that this is the answer, that how do you get from here, which is like, you know, the other end of the universe, to a single payer. One option, of course, is doing what Hillary Clinton suggested at the end of the last election, which is slowly lowering the Medicare age. So you could do that every 5 years, you could lower it by 5 years. And, you know, in 30 years, we'd all wake up and say, oh, we have a single payer system. How did that happen? So that's kind of a stealth approach. Another one is you could start allowing people to buy into Medicare or Medicaid, as some states have proposed. And that would at least ensure that the competing plans would have to be as good as those government offerings. So there are different ways to transition. And for people who say, oh, my gosh, we could never go there, I always like to remind people that before Canada had a single payer system, it didn't, you know, until 1963, I think it was, it didn't. And what happened there? And again, this is another possible way things could go in that direction. One province, I believe it was Saskatchewan.
You know, I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but we have to take another break. And so hold that thought. We'll talk about Saskatchewan in just a moment. My guest is Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, who is editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News. We're talking about the prospects, the pros and cons of a single-payer health system in America. Back in 2 minutes. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News, Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal. We're talking about the prospects for a Medicare for all or single-payer health system in the United States. And before the break, you were telling us, of course, before Canada had a socialized system of healthcare delivery, it did not, and it had to transition.
Right. And, I hope talking about healthcare in Saskatchewan doesn't put off a lot of listeners, but it's really an important lesson. I mean, there was the leader of Saskatchewan believed in single payer healthcare and made the transition for that province in 1961. And, you know, people say, well, states, it's hard for states to do it on their own in this country. It is much harder. But he did it there. And guess what? The other provinces, you know, you always hear in the U.S., whoa, if California did it, everyone would move to California. No, I think what happens once one state or one province does it and it works and people are generally happy, other provinces say, maybe we should do that too. And that's what happened in Canada. So it became a national system in, I believe, 1963 or 64. And I always like to remind people that Tommy Douglas, who was the guy who set this up in Saskatchewan in Canadian polls, is always named the greatest Canadian of all time. So, you know, that's not to say we're going in that direction, but it is to say to all of those people who are out there working in this area that, you know, this gray area that's abuse, that's overcharging, surprise billing, saying no to patients who need things. If you think, you know, we could never go there, the United States will never have a single payer Medicare for all system. Well, I think if we're pushed hard enough, if politicians and patients and doctors are pushed hard enough, they will throw up their hands and say, why not? And I think we're seeing the leading edge of that now. I don't think we're seeing it in any serious way. But, you know, the number of House Republicans who are now supporting a Medicare for all bill has doubled in the last year and a half. So, you know, I think if we believe in market health care and we think that could work, well, the market better start looking like a real market that serves patients. Otherwise, there will be more in the way of price controls, drug negotiated prices, and maybe even a single payer system coming down the pike.
All right, back to the phones now. Brett is on the line in Louisville. Hi, Brett.
Hey, Steph. How you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Love this show. Love the topic. I am actually a business owner, and I was, you know, I've talked about this several times. And one of the biggest challenges for a business owner is actually getting good policies for yourself and your employees. Because I mean, you have to be able to speak insurance when you do these things. And if you want to get really horrified, actually read your insurance policy, because it's hard to figure out what you're covered for. But I thought, especially with the job market these days, you have a lot more independent contractors and things like that. And I know a ton of people that are in a job right now that would love to leave, but they stay because of the benefits. And I'd like your perspective on that, if you could give it to me.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I mean, one of the advantages of the Affordable Care Act was supposed to deal with this thing of job lock, that if you don't like your job, you can go on the exchanges and buy insurance. But I think what we've seen, and I, you know, think the ACA was and is a good idea, is that because of a lot of reasons, partly because it's been somewhat kneecapped by Republican interventions, it hasn't totally lived up to its promises. So the policies you can get on the individual market tend to have narrower networks. They may have higher deductibles. You know, you don't have your employer, and if it's a big employer, in your corner negotiating, troubleshooting, trying to figure out all these insurance things. So I think people who go that route feel vulnerable. Some of them have ended up with very high premiums. Some of them have ended up with good subsidies and good policies. So it's very local and individual. But so I think we are still in a situation where we have serious job lock, where you know, people stay in jobs they hate because it has good benefits. 26-year-olds who come off their parents' policies are extremely vulnerable, maybe not exploring more adventurous parts of the job market, like being an entrepreneur, because they want that health insurance, they want to be covered. And also small businesses, and I think this is really important for America, small businesses are really vulnerable. Like, they would like to hire people, but you're not just paying a salary, you're paying this massive health benefit as well. And so, you know, think about it. If you're a company operating in Denmark or Canada, you just know your employees are getting decent health benefits because they're getting the same health benefits as everyone. Here, it's a total mess, and it's anxiety provoking, and it makes you reluctant to hire. And I think if we believe in entrepreneurialism, which I think we do, we need to give people real options for who want to try entrepreneurship for health insurance. And maybe allowing them to buy into Medicare is not a bad option for them.
I assume
the caller would prefer that to having to look through, you know, 25 different policies, all of which had 100 pages of fine print, and you couldn't quite tell how they would apply to your particular employees.
President Trump has warned that extending Medicare to all Americans, Americans of all ages, could seriously hurt the interests of seniors on Medicare. Is there evidence of that, or are there people talking about the way that senior citizens would be affected by putting Medicare out there for everyone?
No, I think that's kind of a scare tactic, frankly. You know, it was like the death panels we worried about at the beginning of the Affordable Care Act debate. Obviously, you'd need to have different kinds of financing. But in some ways, you could argue that it would make it easier to administer or easier to pay for, because you'd have a lot of younger people who are not so sick. So if they're putting in premiums or paying with their taxes, they're not using health care. So it would involve a huge rethinking of the Medicare system. So, you know, just saying, oh, Medicare for all, well, you can't just expand it and expect it to work. You need to rejigger a whole lot of policies. But, you know, I think the notion that this will be the end of Medicare for seniors is just... there's no real evidence to support that, and so no.
And are the benefits from Medicare pretty comparable to the benefits from a sort of comprehensive private health insurance program? In other words, are there things that Medicare just doesn't pay for that you would expect your employer-provided health insurance to pay for?
No. No, I mean, it's basically the same range of benefits. You know, we still don't have... either in Medicare or private insurance, you know, good coverage for dental, for eye care, for hearing. But that's actually a problem in a lot of socialized or single-payer systems, that there are these carve-outs. So, no, I think my private insurance policy that I'm on now is probably pretty similar to Medicare in terms of its benefits. You know, we both have some amount of deductibles, both have some amount of co-payments, but no, it's basically the same array of benefits.
All right, let's go next on the phone to Mike in Garland. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Chris. I'd like to ask Dr. Rosenthal, the big word you frequently hear mentioned from critics is the word rationing. Now, I... kind of think that there's a certain amount of rationing that occurs currently from private insurers and even self-rationing that patients end up doing because they say, I can't afford this, I won't do it. But whatever you have to say on the topic of rationing, I'd like to hear.
Thanks for calling.
Sure. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There's tons of self-rationing that goes on now because people can't afford what they need, so they often will wait until they're at a critical stage to go to the emergency room before they take care of the smaller things. But I think, you know, when people ask me about rationing, my first response is, yeah, when we get down, you know, now we're at literally 19-20% of GDP. There is so much fat and waste and excess and profit in this system that we're so far away from rationing that, you know, I don't even think, you know, if we're down around 12% of GDP and we're still trying to cut, yeah, then let's talk about rationing. But I do not see rationing as being an issue in this environment of total excess in terms of healthcare. And I don't mean excess in terms of we want people to get the best cancer treatment, we want people with multiple sclerosis to get expensive drugs, but those drugs cost five times as much in our country as they do in the rest of the world, in other developed countries. And it's because we just pay whatever price is asked. We don't do a lot of bargaining. And when we do, it's at kind of small bore, my insurer to your hospital, my insurer to your doctor, instead of as a nation where we could get a much, much better deal because we have the weight of, 300 million people saying we're not paying five times as much as the rest of the world.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Could a system emerge in the United States where wealthy people had exclusive access to the very best doctors and hospitals, or is that already the case in some ways?
I in many of these systems, single-payer systems, and in others that are not single-payer systems but more market-based like Singapore, yes, wealthy people often have access to, I wouldn't say better, but a different kind of feel of healthcare. They may get private rooms. They may get to move up to the front of a waiting list for an elective procedure. They may decide to go to a private doctor. You can do that in England if you want to pay for it. But I think overall, wealthy people in this country, unless you're super duper wealthy, have the same quality of care as poor anyone with insurance, with decent private pay insurance. So, as someone who worked in an emergency room, I can tell you that celebrities and really wealthy people often got worse care because they had a kind of private physician who would say, don't put in an IV. He doesn't like that, or it's embarrassing for him.
Wow.
So I think what we want is not like celebrity care, but we want high quality care for everyone. And sure, maybe some people will, if they have worse insurance or no insurance, or their area doesn't have a good public hospital, maybe they'll have to wait a little longer. But you don't want people waiting for heart attacks, for cancer care. I mean, the really important things you want people to be able to get, no matter. And if you want like a private room and, catered meals from a 3-star Michelin restaurant, well, good, pay for that.
As politicians continue to talk about these ideas, surely some of them will start to articulate specific plans. When that happens, Elizabeth, what can we look for? What questions should we ask in order to judge for ourselves whether these particular ideas for doing universal health care are good or bad?
Well, I think you have to look hard at, you have to ask the question, first of all, what do you mean by single payer? What do you mean by Medicare for all? How are you going to get there? I think you have to ask, I always think a good test case question is, so what are you going to do about drug prices? Because drug prices, everyone agrees that they're really high. We know a bunch of things that would bring them down, like allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices, having some kind of national negotiation for drug prices that isn't Medicare, allowing FDA to step in to review drug prices, allowing us to import medicines from other countries. All of those things would work. So if someone says, I'm going to bring down drug prices, and they don't tell you one of those things or don't have a rational plan, you should say, wow, this is just talk. I don't believe you. And I think, you have to look at every part of healthcare that way. People say, wow, these bills are too high. Okay, what have you done in your state about surprise bills? We hear a lot about that in Texas, people who go to an in-network emergency room and they have an out-of-network doctor, so they suddenly are getting a bill for $5,000. Okay, you tell me hospitals get away with murder. What are you doing about surprise bills? There should be a plan for all of this stuff.
Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal is editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News, a trained emergency physician and author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Elizabeth, it has been really interesting to talk to you. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think, and you can be a subscriber to the Think podcast by going to your favorite podcast app, searching for Think, and signing up. We hope that you will check out the website as well. It's think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.